Okay. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Closer. I have a really raspy voice, and sometimes people can't hear me. First of all, I want to thank the committee, Ryan and Jim and Anil and everybody. Mike and Zed and Lily and Pete. And, it's actually a really huge honor. Here's the honor. The honor is I know the labor of love that went into planning this and the obstacles that these guys came upon, and no matter what, they threw this beautiful convention. There's a lot of stuff that, like, we don't know about, and, you know, it wasn't easy, and they came up against stuff, and, you know, like, we do things no matter what, and for the bigger purpose, and this is a beautiful convention, and I am beyond humbled and honored to be the first speaker, like, the, you know, like, no, I know Ruben was the first speaker. Ruben. Sorry. But you know what I mean. Like, Ruben and I are both so honored to be considered to be the first speakers at the first fourth dimension. That I'm sure is going to have a long life and go on for many, many, many years. And so I'm really grateful. And thank you, Jim. There you are. I just want to acknowledge a few things before I get into, like, all that stuff. My beautiful friends, Rich and Kenny. You know, I don't know, a lot of you know that, like, the hot and dry started here, you know, 200 years ago or whenever it did. And this was the first hotel. And my beautiful friends, Rich and Kenny, met at this pool, this little pool out here. And, you know, they've been together 26 years as a result of meeting. Actually, I believe today is your anniversary, right? Like, or yesterday, or somewhere around there, okay. So, be careful with who you're flirting with at the pool. Because you could be waking up next to them in 26 years. The first time I believe that I came to Hot and Dry was 28 years ago, and I believe I came with Kenny, and you know, by this pool, and it was like, you know, 300 gay, sober, beautiful men. I was in my 20s, I literally had no self-esteem, and I hadn't quite gotten to the point yet of being okay with myself. I hadn't done all the work or whatever, and I was terrified, and I'm by the pool and terrified, and everybody was just joyous in the pool and splashing around, and I'm sitting on the side, like, you know, that, you know, the one that sits on the side, like, you know, and Kenny, who is actually, you know, 2 years, you know, or a year less sober than I am, and he looks at me and he said, "Oh God, John, get over yourself. Take off your shirt and get in the pool. No one is looking at you." And I looked like, exactly, like, I was like, "What?" And he goes, "John, they're all so self-obsessed. They're only looking at themselves." And I took off my shirt and I got in the pool, and my adventure began with Hot and Dry and roundups and conventions, and I love them and I go to them, and they're amazing. And then, you know, the last acknowledgement that I need to make is to Jonathan and Adam and Brian. I'm a crier, you guys, I start crying. And I cry over important sobriety things because it is so important to me. And I have the utmost respect for Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety and the people who trudge this road that I don't take for granted. And you guys are amazing, and I hope that you guys find what I found here And I can just, you know, my big words of wisdoms would be that it's truly is easier to stay here than to postpone the inevitable. And you know, Brian, I saw you Thursday night. My business partner Willie and I, we own this restaurant here in Palm Springs, and that wasn't a cheap plug. Willie, pass out cards, quick. No, but anyway, and Thursday night, like a bunch of guys came in, and it was really beautiful and sweet. And Brian came in, and you were, you know, you greeted me with this big hug, and it was really sweet. And you know, we recognized each other and knew each other. I did not know that night you had one day of sobriety. And you were beaming, and there was so much light. And I even said to someone, like, God, like that table is so great, and da-da-da. It was all the Minnesota guys. Big shout out to Minnesota. You guys are so beautiful here. All right, so today by the pool, God, this last half hour sitting here, I've literally been jumping out of my skin. So today by the pool, I was like, oh, you know, I went to the secret workshop, and I told a big secret today, and then, you know, of course, when you reveal something so secret about yourself, you have to go out and like, ha ha ha, you know, make light and fun of everything like that. Stuff it. Anyway, so we were all giggling by the pool, and I said, well, what should I talk about tonight? Should I talk about suicide? Should I talk about Cher? Should I talk about Jose? Should I talk about, you know? And everybody started saying, Cher, talk about, you know, of course. You know, and then I thought, no, should I out Diva Rubin from Diana Ross to Cher tonight? I don't know. Anyway, so. All right, so I'm from Van Nuys, California. And today I say Van Nuys, California. For many years, even into sobriety, I always said Sherman Oaks, California. Because Sherman Oaks was like fancy and beautiful, and Van Nuys is not. You know, I was a minority in Van Nuys. And anyway, so I'm from Van Nuys, and you know, I grew up in that family, you know, that family that's just, you know, my dad's drunk, my mom's an alcoholic, and you know, they're both from the South, and you know, they were just beat on each other, and my dad was violent and horrible and a hideous, you know, father, should not have been a father, and you know, I don't want to get too into it too much, but my sister and I would be cowering under the bed, like when he was in rages, and he'd pull us out to watch. You know, like, look what your whore mother's doing. And so, at the age of like 12, I needed an escape. Because what was going through my head is, I just want to blow my fucking brains out. I can't live like this. I can't live like with this father that's so violent and my mother who takes it and they're drunk all the time and high. And so, and we're going into the Cher story. So like the only thing, honestly, and I know it sounds silly, the only thing I lived for was watching the Sonny and Cher show on television. And I know it sounds really dramatic, but it truly was the only thing that kept me alive, or the only thing that gave me 1 ounce of hope, because it was such a distraction from my life, and it was just pure fantasy and beauty and glamour, and it was just like, I don't know, like I you know, I didn't want to be Cher, I just wanted to like, I don't know, I just, you know, it just was so, I couldn't wait to see that gown and that belly button every week. Anyway, so at 13 years old, I would cut school and from the Valley and take 3 buses to CBS Studios to watch the Sonny and Cher show being taped. And 1 week, there was a, you have to get there, like, it was ridiculous. You have to get there at 8 a.m. to get tickets for the show that night. And so I missed a bus, and I got there late, and all the tickets were gone. And, you know, I thought my life was over. I'm 13, and, you know, taking 3 buses to Hollywood. And So I go over to the farmer's market, which is now the Grow, but before it was just the farmer's market and a huge field and parking lot. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm not going home. I'm going to run away. I'm going to da 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 da. And I look up and Cher's walking by me. And I think, oh my God, you know, it's like, wow, there's Cher, you know. So again, 13, already, I'm already like taking pills and stuff. My mom was feeding me pills by now. And I thought, I'm gonna follow her. And she's gonna walk back to CBS. And then she's got that long walk from Farmer's Market to CBS. And she'll be in the parking lot and there's nothing she can do or she can't get away. So I'll just wait until she gets in the middle. And so I did, and she was walking, and I, behind her, I called out to Cher, and she didn't stop. She just went, yes. And I and I said, because I was maybe had a couple of crosstop mini whites in me. Hi, my name is John, and I live in the San Fernando Valley, and I take 3 buses to come over here and to get tickets to the show, and I see the show every week, and they didn't have tickets this week, and I don't know what I'm gonna do. And she stopped dead in her tracks, and she had the biggest smile on her face, and she turns around, and she goes, you're not old enough to see this show. And I said, I know, but no one's ever said anything, and I don't know what I'm gonna do. And she says, come on. And so we walked through the back gate, and we walked to her car, and she said, will you help me carry stuff up to my dressing room? And I'm 13, and I'm like carrying Cher's stuff up to her dressing room at the studio up the back way, and we go into her dressing room, I sit it down, she picks up the phone, and she calls this guy named Dave, and she says, Dave, my friend John, and she's like, what's your last name? And I like told her my last name, and she goes, he's here visiting, give him all access in the studio, and then mark my seat for him. And I was like, oh my God, you know, like, I mean, truly the story, if you knew where I was coming from in that shithole in Van Nuys to being there, it was like, it was wow. And so I go and I just putz around the studio and I'm like, and I go and they, you know, it's like 6 hours later and the show's getting ready to start. They sit me in the seat. And the show's going on, and it was about halfway through the taping. And they finish a number, and Cher looks right up and goes, John, are you having a good time? And I promise you, you guys, it was the first time in my entire life that anyone had ever acknowledged me. And so the obsession began. First love wasn't a boy, it was Cher. You know, and it was a beautiful love affair, and it's still going on, but truly, it was the first acknowledgement, and, you know, segue to many years later, I sporadically have, you know, kept in touch a little bit, and here and there and stuff, but, you know, whenever we see each other, we like acknowledge and hug and kiss and stuff. And so Scott was, we were in Vegas seeing Cher, my husband and I, and Scott and I was dancing with Cher, and we were backstage, and we were walking down the hallway, and Cher was walking towards us, and like Cher was like, oh my God, John, yeah. And we hugged and kissed, and like that, and like was like talking and chatting. I said, this is my husband, Dan, and she's like, how do you and Scott know each other? And like, we're chatting. And my husband is standing there like this. And so then we walk away, and he goes, babe, like, how do you know? What is like? And I said, babe, remember I told you the story when I met her when I was 13 years old? He goes, yeah, but that was 50 years ago. So cute. All right. All that, none of that has nothing to do with sobriety, but it actually does. So segue into, you know, I have a few points that I love to talk about. I love to talk about my last week of sobriety, or my last week of drinking. Because, like, the drinking, like, my dad was violent. I got into my first relationship when I was 19 with a guy that I stayed in until I got sober, and he was just as violent as my dad. And, you know, I got beaten regularly, like my mother got beaten, and he would tell me, I was going to say daily, but probably hourly, what a worthless piece of shit I was, and how we have no friends because no one likes me, and we were just drunks, you know, living in the valley, like being drunks, and it was violent, and he would beat me up pretty bad, and he beat me down for like a long time, and so the last week, you know, drunk all the time, cocaine addiction, speed freak, and then the last week of my, well, not really the last week of my drinking, the last week I got pulled over three times in one week for drunk driving. And the first time was we had gone up to Newhall with my lover at the time, and his mother lived there, and he was in a rage, and he hit his fist and broke my window and was getting out to go into his mother's house, and I was sitting in the car, and I thought, I'm going to die tonight if I go in that house. He is in such a rage. So I have a choice, go in this house and die tonight, or put this car in reverse and get the fuck out of here. And I said, well, I'm gonna get the fuck out of here. So I put the car in reverse, and of course he saw me put it in reverse, and he comes and he jumps right in front of the car. I'm in the street, and I'm thinking, oh God, what am I gonna do? And I thought, okay, I'm gonna die or I'm gonna hit him. And I floored it. And he went flying up over my car, and I just thought, like, oh, thank God. And then, like, red lights went on, and the cops pulled me over because they were sitting right there. They saw it, of course. And it was kind of beautiful. Like, we went to the Newhall police station, and they said, first they said, like, was that your lover? And I was like, God, how would you know that? Like, how do you know it's not a buddy? And they were like, well, you know. Look at your outfit. No. So finally, like Al said and done, they're driving to the police station. They said, look, we're not going to book you on drunk driving because you're really drunk. What we're going to book you on are your three warrants for your arrest. And so when we get to the police station, just sit and don't say a word so we can just not book you on your drunk driving and just book you on your warrants. And I said, okay, and I did. And then I got out and, you know, like, you know, got out and went right to the bar, 6:30 in the morning, right to the bar. And, you know, drank. And then, like, you know, two nights later, I got pulled over again. And then two nights later, I ended up in the hospital with alcohol colitis, bleeding out of every orifice. And the doctor said I had alcohol poisoning. And he, like, it's so funny, I remember so distinctly, he said, do you drink a lot? And I said, no, I don't really drink a lot. He said, do you drink daily? And I said, well, yeah, I drink daily. And he says, well, do you have more than one? And I said, well, yeah. And he goes, how many? I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, you might want to cut back a bit. And I said, okay. But I find it odd now that I'm sober, like they knew, like, why didn't, like, they get more, like, honey, send someone in to talk to me. Anyway, so out of the hospital in a day, Sunday tea dance at this on the boulevard, on Santa Monica Boulevard, and with my friend Louise, and she's in head to toe spandex. It's 1985, and big feathered hair, and you know, almost like out of a White Snake video. And I said, I'm gonna go get the car. You wait here. And I went to get the car, and we were like so fucked up out of our mind. And I got in the car, and I drove, you know, from where on the boulevard was all the way to Santa Monica and Crescent Heights. When I remembered that I forgot to get Louise. And so I put it in reverse and I backed down Santa Monica Boulevard like four blocks to where she was. And she ran across the street and got in the car and started screaming at me and stuff. And we took off again and red lights came on. And, you know, I just got pulled over and the cop said, you know what you did? And I said, I really don't. And he said, you just, you know, backed down Santa Monica Boulevard four blocks. And I said, I know. And I literally, I was that blasé. And he said, have you been drinking? I said, yes, sir. And he said, how much? I said, a lot. And he said, what's a lot? And I said, a lot. And he goes, more than 10. I said, more than 20. And Louise is hitting me. And then the cop says, have you done any drugs? I said, yes, sir. And he goes, what have you done? I said, a ton of cocaine. We start screaming. And I knew the gig was up. And, you know, of course they arrested me and took me off. And, you know, 6 a.m. the next day, you know, Louise and James came to get me. And, you know, we headed right to, oh, what's that bar? It's now Trunks, but it wasn't back then. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it was open. It was open at like 6 a.m. Anyway, so we headed there. You know, we started all over again. But as a result to all those, you know, three times in 1 week thing, you know, I got a shitload of court dates of AA meetings that I had to go to, and I had never heard of AA. And I had a friend, Winston, who was a big drunk, and he said, "Come on, we'll go. I'll take you." And I said, "No, this is something I got to do on my own." And you know, so I go to my first AA meeting, and it was at the West Hollywood Drug and Alcohol Center above the pizza place. And I was terrified. I was 26 years old, and it was 1986. And I go to this meeting, and I'm sitting there with my hands in my face, just so embarrassed to be there. I was so embarrassed. And they do the meeting. I can't tell you one thing I heard there until they did these things called birthday cakes. And this guy took a cake, and I heard him say, "Hi, I'm Jack, and I'm 1 year sober." And I looked up because I recognized the voice, and it was a guy that my lover and I used to have three ways with. And the first thing that ran through my mind was, I have to get out of this room before he sees me. And I did. I got up and left. And I went back the next night, and I went back the next night, and I went back the next night. And I went back every single night and never had enough courage or self-esteem to ask them to sign my court card. And I would go to the meeting and I would get in my car and I would drive down to the Gold Coast where I had my favorite bartender who made my favorite drink, and I would sit there and I would get drunk till 2 a.m. and then I would go home and then I would go to the AA meeting, not get my court card signed, go to the bar, get drunk, go home. And I did this probably every night for like a month before I had enough courage to get the first signature. And, you know, I mean, if I knew then what I know now. I'm kidding, Brian, don't try that. Anyway, so, but I started getting my signatures, and I would do the same thing. I would go to the meeting every night, and always at the West Hollywood Drug and Alcohol Center, because it's the only thing I knew, and they always had some kind of a meeting every single night there. And then I would get in my car and go down to go to my bar stool. That had been my bar stool for years, and my drink would be sitting there. It was a vodka with a Southern Comfort Shooter, and I would start with a Southern Comfort Shooter and then drink my vodka, and then when the vodka was done, I would do the Southern Comfort Shooter and then drink the vodka. And my favorite bartender, Tom McGillen, made the strongest drinks, and it was amazing. And I did this for 3 months, and my court card was long finished being signed, and I would still go to the meeting and then go to this bar and drink into oblivion. And it was November 4th, 1986. And I went to my meeting and I went to this bar and I went to my bar stool and my drinks were sitting there. And I looked at this bartender in the eye and I said, you know, Tom, I don't think I'm gonna drink tonight. And he said, babe, I don't blame you. You were really, really, really wasted last night. And I said, I know, but I don't think that's why I'm not gonna drink. I'm an alcoholic and I can't stop drinking. So then what I didn't know is that I was taking my first step with my bartender. And my bartender looked at me, Tom McGillen, who was the most beautiful guy. And he says, John, I'm 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and anything I can do to help you, I will. And so, now here's the tricky part. Brian, Adam, and Jonathan, don't try this. But for my first 11 months of sobriety, I sat in this bar with Tom drinking cranberry juice. And during that 11 months of sobriety, because that was my safety net with Tom, is I never met one of you in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would finish doing the Lord's Prayer and I would run out the door and run to the bar. And in 11 months, I never got one phone number nor said hello to one person in the room. Not one. And at 11 months, Tom says to me, come in the bathroom, I want to show you something. And I was like, oh, finally, God. Yay. And he took me in and he pulled down his pants. And, you know, he had all those red blotches and, you know, which was Kaposi's. And, you know, but then it was 1986 and, you know, it was like the gay disease and stuff. And, you know, I was like, you know, Tom, you need to get to the doctor, man. This is not good. And Tom did. He went to the doctor and, you know, 3 weeks later, Tom was dead, and it was devastating. It was devastating on a selfish level because who was going to take care of me? Because I didn't have any of you, and Tom was it, and stuff. So I went to this meeting out in the valley, and on Moore Park, and I got there. Walked in, the seat was across the room, and I thought, oh, I like to sit by the door because I don't have to say hi to anybody, and sat in the seat and finished the meeting, did the Lord's Prayer, and as I was walking out, this guy jumped in front of me, and he said, hi, my name is Dalton, and I said, hi, and he said, I've been noticing you, you don't stick around, and you run out the door, and you never talk to anybody, and I said, oh, yeah, you know, looking at the ground, because couldn't look at anybody in the eye, and I said, yes. And he said, well, what are you doing now? Do you want to go to coffee? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, do you have plans? And I said, well, no, I don't. And he said, well, then you're coming to coffee. And he goes, meet me at Dupar's on Ventura Boulevard. And so I said, okay. And I thought, okay, you got to do this. It was huge. And I pulled in the parking lot and went in. And I walked in the door and I looked. And in the back booth, there were 10 people there, and I thought, I can't do this. And Dalton started waving his arm like this, and I was like, ah, and I walked back there, and I sat there with my head down. I literally, when I tell you, I had no self-esteem, nor could I look anybody in the eye. I looked at the ground and listened to these guys for 2 hours talk about absolutely nothing. And I hope I never forget this feeling, because I felt like I want this so bad. I want what they have. Like, I just want to be like normal like them and have a conversation with someone. And then they started talking about the newcomer at the meeting, and did you give them the number, and da-da-da. And I spoke up for the first time and I said, I've never gotten a number in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, 10 pens came out, 10 pieces of paper, you know, came at me, and I was like, oh, great, and I put them in my pocket thinking, like, I'm never, ever gonna use these. And they were pieces of papers then, because, you know, back then we had to write things, we didn't punch them in a phone. So we were walking out the door, and Dalton grabbed my arm, and he said, why don't you give me your phone number? And I said, okay. And I gave him my phone number, and I thought, shit. And 2 days later, Dalton called me. And he said, Derek and I are going to the zoo. Do you want to go? It was the day that changed my life. Because A, I had never been invited anywhere, except up to Cher's dressing room. I had never been invited anywhere to do anything. And my mind was like, what do they want? What do they want to do? Like, what is this? Like, what's going on? And I met up with them, and we went to the Los Angeles Zoo, and we walked around this zoo for 4 hours talking about absolutely nothing, doing nothing, and it was the best day of my life. To this day, it was the best day of my life. It was the beginning of it all. I slowly started being able to raise my hand. I'd never taken a 30-day chip, a 60-day chip, a 90-day chip, a 6-month chip, a 9-month chip. I didn't have enough self-esteem in the meetings to raise my hand. I took a 1-year cake because Dalton made me. So, also by the pool today. So I had said in my head, knowing I was going to speak here, like, maybe not going to talk about Dalton so much, you know, blah, blah. Dalton and I became really great friends. We lived together for 17 years. We were almost like a married couple that wasn't married, or sex or anything like, but we lived together for 17 years. We had a joint checking account. We had a joint credit card, and we owned 2 homes together. And we were just friends. Like, you know, throughout our sobriety, we each had separate boyfriends and stuff like that. But we were, you know, as close to this day, it's probably the most intimate relationship I've ever had. My husband's not here, is he? Anyway, so I thought, like, okay, I'm not gonna talk so much about it anyway. And then beautiful Brian, by the pool today, says, hey, my first hot and dry, was all these years ago, and I remember this thing where this guy committed suicide, and he chose hot and dry to be the weekend that he committed suicide. And my eyes just welled up in tears, and I thought, how the fuck could I not talk about Dalton? You know, let me tell you, this guy fucking single-handedly saved my life, taught me everything about service work, taught me everything about sobriety, taught me everything about showing up, taught me everything about how to live. Do you know, I had never, ever, 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 this is not a lie, ever had a fresh vegetable until I met Dalton. And so we had this great relationship, and you know, Dalton was, you know, his whole sobriety was filled with love and service, and he knew how to love everybody else but himself. And he did choose hot and dry weekend when everybody was down here, and he committed suicide. And you know, it was a tough one. You know, it was a tough one. But we stay sober no matter what. You know, we stay sober no matter what. No matter what. You know, so like my parents have both died in sobriety. You know those hideous parents that I talked about? You know, you get sober and you start doing all that work and you know, like I hated my father so much, and like I thought my mother was a saint because my father beat on her all the time. And then my first sponsor said to me, why does your mother stay? And I thought, oh, right, she has a part in it, right? Like, why would she keep her kids in a situation like that? Anyway, so tons of work later, tons of therapy later. I actually had a relationship with my family. And, you know, my father was this crotchety, like, old man, too. And, you know, I ended up moving him here to Palm Springs, and I took care of him the last few years of his life, and I bought him a house. And, you know, and he acknowledged me twice in his life. He said to me, and it was the best that he could do, he said, are you still going to those meetings? And I said, I am. And he said, they seem to be doing good. And I said, yeah. And he didn't say it like that. He said it really like caring. And then the only time he ever acknowledged my sexuality was, and it was hard for them not to acknowledge my sexuality with the friends that I had all the time, like around, is he said, you know my retirement ring that I gave you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, since it's probably a good chance you're not gonna have children, can you make sure your nephew gets it? And I said, I will. And so that was his way of acknowledging me that I'm never going to get married, that I'm gay and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I took it and it was great. And, you know, he was fine. And, you know, when he was sick in his last, I saw the beauty of this program, you guys. Now I'm all over the place. But the beauty of this program is when you form these lasting relationships here in these rooms, and it's like Rich goes to see my father in the hospital when he's in the hospital, you know, it's like, okay, where are we? I mean, other than Indian Wells. All right, so I get this sponsor, and my first sponsor, and he's a crotchety old man, and he's big book, and blah, 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 and really hardcore, and I'm so willing, I'm following every direction he has. And it was a lot. And he had this thing, you know, it was the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and he had this thing where he would take us. First, we're in the middle of the steps, and we get to, like, I do one and two really easy, but I refuse to do three. I said, I'm not doing step three because I hate God, fuck God. You know, I'm never going to accept God into my life. And, you know, he's killing all my friends, and I had that shitty childhood, and blah, 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 blame, 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 blame. No accountability, no responsibility. And I said, let's just go to the fort. And he said, well, no, it doesn't quite work that way. But so he started taking me to the hospitals at midnight when everybody was dying. It was a period when everybody was dying, like in 1988, 89, 90, and we would go to these hospitals and at midnight, and it was past visiting hours, and he would just like talk to the nurses and tell like the eight of us, just go in a room, it doesn't matter what room you go in, just go in a room and start talking. And it was during the time where you had to wear masks, and you know, and we would just go in, no mask, and just talk, and these beautiful people were laying there. And their eyes were wide open, they weren't sleeping, and they were scared to death, and they were abandoned by their family, they were abandoned by their friends because they had a plague. And we would go and we would just sit there and chat and talk. But because not that much was known about it then, you know, you could get it from breathing the air or touching or whatever. So I was cautious, I would sit across the room and there was this one guy, and I would race to go to his room. I don't know why. And he was this little Latin guy, and his name was Jose. And he was sitting there. And every night we would have conversation about something. And then one night he said, he was crying, and he said, I'm really scared. No one comes to see me but you. And I have no one. And I got up and I walked over and I started stroking his face, and it's covered with Kaposi sores. I meant covered. He looked like a leopard. And I'm rubbing his face, and halfway through rubbing his face, I realized that I was rubbing his face. And I thought, oh no. And I started like breathing hard and hyperventilating, thinking, oh my God, if I remove my hand, he's gonna think, like, you know, that he's toxic or poison, but if I don't, I might get this. And, you know, I'm not being dramatic. Back then, you didn't know, you know. And we didn't have the information, I should say. And I started trembling, and I started trembling. And right then, my sponsor is standing in the doorway, and I said, Dick, what is happening? What is happening? And he said, it's God working in Jose's life. And I heard it. And right then, all my hatred for God or higher power, my resistance and everything, and I got it, and I heard, Dick, it was God working in Jose's life. Oh, you stupid fuck, John, it's not about you. It's about Jose. And it's about how you need to show up for Jose. And we left that hospital, and I looked at him and I said, I'm ready to take my third step. And I took my third step, and I've never looked back since. And I also right then dedicated my life to this program and to love and service, and how could I show up? And I've showed up, like, you know, probably not as much as I can, but I show up big, and I'm a maximum service. You know, also during this, period, started really fellowshipping, like meeting tons of people and really getting involved and meetings, and it was all about going to meetings and you know, now I have God in my life and everything's beautiful and it's a big love, you know, literally went from daylight to dark, you know, or dark to daylight. And these are just points that are really, really proud, that I'm proud of in my life. Like, I'm really proud of how I found, accepted a higher power in my life. And it probably took something that dramatic to, you know, either that or a brick up the side of my head. You know, I started hanging out with these guys, Dalton, and everybody was like, you gotta come to Alexis's house and play cards. You gotta come play. And Alexis was this force in AA that was like this big Nelly. I mean, skinny, like, but tall. Like Nelly. Almost looked like a girl, that like David Bowie androgynous type. And like, just terrified the fuck out of me, you know? And Tom's like, you gotta come to Alexis's house. Come on, come on. I'm like, I can't. He's like, come on. It's fun. So I started going to Alexis's house, and we would play poker. And it was the night that it was a Miss America on TV. And it was so impromptu, you guys. It was like, oh my God, let's all get dressed up and have a Miss America pageant here in Alexis's dressing room. And so there were three volunteers that got dressed up. And they did the thing, you know, they got wigs and dresses and stuff, and it was all impromptu because Alexis had everything in her closet, so it was quick. And I remember it so distinctly because it was fun. You know, it was fun, and not a lot of thought had to go into it, and it was great. And, you know, Philip Michon was the first winner, you know. Great. He was beautiful. And then we were like, let's make this a tradition and do it next year. And so then the next year, Miss America, we did the same thing. And I believe Scott Reinders was the winner. Yeah, I think so. Scott Reinders. And then, I'm looking at Jeffrey because Jeffrey's like, but you know, she doesn't remember. I meant she doesn't remember because she wasn't there. You know, segue, side note, you know, I've known Jeffrey since he got sober, and I used to pick him up at the Venice house and take him to meetings, and he had this red curly hair, and he was like me. When I was new, I would sit over and just cry and head down and stuff. He couldn't look anybody in the eye. He couldn't look up. All he did was cry for like fucking 9 months. He cried. Like, girl, what are you crying about? He said, I don't know. Anyway. So back to the ADD, la 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 la. Anyway, so we go. So the next year, okay, da da. And then the third year, it was in Dalton and I's living room. And it was also the first year, you know, I'm sure there's conflicting stories. I'm sure there's a few people saying, oh, that was my idea. That someone said, we should put out a bucket and collect money and donate it to AIDS. And cleared out our furniture, and we set up chairs, and we built a little stage in our dining room, and like tinfoil stars and stuff, and it was really the cheesiest thing, and there were pictures to prove how cheesy it was. And Alexis won that year, third year she won. And I think it was rigged, actually. I really do. I think Megan rigged that for Alexis to win. Anyway, but we raised money, and we donated it. Jeffrey, do you remember, I think, was that 457, like maybe 450, 250? Anyway, we were so proud that we raised like $400 with like 35 people sitting in our living room in this little, you know, dumpy apartment in Hollywood. And And then the next year, it was at Rich and Kenny's house. And then, like, it got a little bigger with, like, more contestants. And then the next year, it was at the Richard Pryor Theater. And I think it was there for a couple of years, and it got bigger, and then we started getting celebrity judges, and then it was like at the El Rey Theater, and then it got sold out, and it got bigger, and we raised all this money, and then it got bigger, and we moved to the Wiltern, to the Wiltshire Cabell, and sold that out a few years, and then we moved to the Wiltern. And then Alexis got really sick. And it was Alexis's baby. And Alexis was a force, and Alexis created this beautiful show. And the last year, Alexis walked in to rehearsals, could barely walk, sat for like 10 minutes, had to go in the afternoon, couldn't stay for the show. And we did the show that night, and it ended. I think it ended out of memory for Alexis, like, and I think it was a few years that we realized, like, oh God, that was the wrong decision. Like, like, we rebrand it and bring it back and keep raising all this money and in honor of Alexis, and that's what we've done. And you know, and today, like, Jeffrey is the producer and director of it. And, you know, we raise, you know, $500,000 to $600,000 a year in this one night at this theater. That of this show that was built in this little cruddy apartment of Alexis's on an idea and a fluke. And our running joke backstage is, we're all just a bunch of drunks, honey, taking all their money to damn it. Like, none of us know what we're doing. Well, Jeffrey does, but you know, it is truly, if any of you have ever been, it's a dog and pony show, man. There is not one beauty in there. Well, except for Spencer. Yeah. Spencer, where are you? Spencer's a winner. Anyway, you know, the whole point of all this, you guys, is like, I hope is that, like, I went from this hopeless guy that was sort of forced getting sober and resisted it so much to having that wall up, to learning how to, simple things, learning how to uncross my arms. I don't sit in meetings with my arms crossed. As corny as it sounds, it just keeps it out rather than lets it in. I'm this odd bird. I'm so odd. And I think I'm turning into that crunchy old, like, 30-year sobriety guy, you know, that's like, wah, wah, back in my day, you know, which I always resented when I was, like, in my 20s getting sober. Anyway, so, like, you know, and I do these simple things. FYI, my first sponsor, Dick, died, and I've had my sponsor, Jennifer, for the past 25 years. I've never had a need to change sponsors. And sometimes I've hated the shit she's told me to do. Sometimes I've resented the stuff she's told me to do. And sometimes I've loved her so much for saving my life all the time. But guess what? I don't give her up and I don't fire her. And, like, who would have thought of, I'm firing my sponsor? Like, God, like, no one's getting paid. You're not firing. You know? Anyway, so I do some really simple stuff. I do some really simple stuff to stay sober. And this is just what I do. You know, just what I do. And I've always done. I've done this for 30 years. I don't walk into a meeting late. Ever. If I'm not there on time, I go to another meeting. I never leave a meeting early. Ever. It's too disruptive for me. Like, who am I to get up in the middle of a room and walk through it and interrupt your meeting? You might miss the message of whatever that is. And this is just for me. And I never bring my cell phone into a meeting. I don't bring it in. I leave it in the car because I know me. I know me. I'll be on it. If I bring it in, I'll be on it. So I leave it in the car. I try to sit as close as possible because I have a really, really easy knack of being distracted. I never, ever. We planned it. We did. No, rude. I'm kidding. We could all have fun. And I also, and kind of going back on that point just for me, is I never get up in the middle of the meeting. And this is what I think, and this is just, now, this is just my opinion and probably a judgment, is when I see someone getting up and going like, oh, I gotta go get more coffee, or I gotta go to the bathroom or whatever, in my head, I just wonder, I'm wondering like, are they hearing something that's making them uncomfortable and they're gonna miss the message? And, you know, what is it? Maybe it's subliminal that they're not, you know, like, I don't know. Just like, I just, someone told me this. It's probably my sponsor that said, why can't you just love yourself for 1 hour a day? Just love yourself for that 1 hour. Turn off from everything and just sit there and be present in the meeting and be willing to be uncomfortable. Because there's some uncomfortable shit that happens in these rooms. You know, and you gotta have that willingness to sit through it all, no matter what. No matter what. No matter what. No matter what. If your best friend commits suicide, no matter what. If this guy you idolize that started this amazing show dies, no matter what. If your best friend in the world fucking gets cancer and you move him into your house and you take care of him the last 11 months of his life and you help him die and you sit in the room with him when he's taking his last breath, you stay sober no matter what. And here's how I know that it's possible. I know it's possible because I'm living proof that you can stay sober no matter what. So I will just leave you with this, that there is nothing, nothing in this world that comes before Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I first said that to my husband, he was like, what? My husband doesn't, he's not program and he doesn't know program and nor does he need program. Maybe another program, but not this one. You know, he's like, what? And I'm like, babe, you don't understand. It's because I put that first, that we have this big, huge life. I have a big life, you guys. I have a big life. You know, as a result, oh God, am I out of time? Oh, I'm out of time. Oh yeah. As a result of like, as a result of Dalton committing suicide and me escaping to Palm Springs to like shut down and hide out, I decided to move to Palm Springs full time. As a result of that and me being so shut down over it, I decided to go out and on the anniversary of Dalton's death, because I couldn't deal with the feelings of it. It was so fucking painful. It was ridiculous how painful it was that night and on the anniversary of his death. And I dressed really slutty and I was gonna go get laid at the bar down here. And I thought I'm just gonna have tons of anonymous sex and fuck this and I'm not gonna feel a feeling. And like, mind you, like I'm like, then I was like, you know, 21 years sober. And I go into the bar, and then I walk in the bar. I was like, this is a mistake. And I walk to the back of the bar, and I turn around and I walk out. And as I'm walking out the door, I was there no more than 2 minutes. This guy put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, where are you going? You just got here. And I said, I'm leaving because I have to get out of here. And he said, you're the best looking guy in here. And I thought, ugh. What a line, you fucking asshole. And I looked up and, you know, he was really tall. And I looked up at him and I looked in his eyes And I thought, oh my God, this guy really thinks I'm the best looking guy in here. Like, I could tell just by looking at me, he really meant it. And I said, if you want to talk to me, we have to go outside. And we went outside, and he said, and it was in the light, it goes, your shorts are ripped, your ass is hanging out. Anyway, long story short, because I'm going to get off, we went home and we tripped, and he asked for my phone number, and I said, why? And he said, because I want to ask you out on a date. And I said, I don't go out on dates. And I gave him my phone number, and he called me the next day, and he asked me out, and we went out on our first date. And halfway through dinner, he said, how come you're not drinking? And he was having a glass of wine. And I said, because I don't drink. And he said, oh, why? And I was like, then I told him, I said, well, because, you know, I have a drinking problem, I'm allergic, and I go to meetings and stuff like that. And he goes, well, this is never going to work. And I said, why? And he said, all my friends drink, and if none of your friends drink, we're never going to work. And I said, well, can we get through dessert? Anyway, so back to my big life. Today, this man is my husband, and it clearly worked, and we had 185 people at our wedding, and half were his friends, and half were my friends, and everybody got along great, and I believe that Dalton sent me him. It's my gift. And we have this little hummingbird that literally is at our window, our big sliding glass window, buzzing around. And Dan says nightly, I wonder if that's the same hummingbird, John. And I always say, it is. It's Dalton's coming to say hello. I am so grateful to be sober, you guys. I am so, 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 so grateful. Nothing I respect more than Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very clear that I would not be here without all of you being here. And thank you again, and thank you.